wake up and join the class. Dance is Tuesday at 8 in the morning. I've given you the material, folded up the sheet, one side of the 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with whatever prayers, points, or formulas you want to put on it. I am still setting up the Q&A room. It's registration time, so the person normally sets up the rooms, and I said overwhelmed by physics students asking lots of questions about registration, so that sort of fell through the cracks, but I'm trying to get that established. It will, I'm asking for 5:30 p.m. Monday, so it'll be down an hour and a half in there. They may change a little bit to plan room availability. That's totally when I can work it out. So just a note, there are a few of you who maybe truly have a memorable day Tuesday, maybe a spectacularly memorable day where you have an exam, then we have a lecture, and you could have workshop and lab all on the same day. So those of you who just have the exam and the lecture, you should feel very happy that that's all the physics you got, or very sad that that's all the physics you got, depending on your point of view. I am going to have lecture on Tuesday because I don't really want to lose the lecture time in terms of delivering the product for which you are paying. So we will do that. And, you know, we're thin today, too. That's too bad. Usually on this post-exam class, it's a little bit thin. I mean, I'm okay if you want to bring a beer or whatever after the exam, or coffee, but whatever works. You ought to come if lecture speaks to you at all. I mean, if it doesn't, then fine. I don't know why you're here right now. But if my lectures often speak to you, you should try to be here Tuesday, because we're getting into some stuff that I consider to be the oddest stuff that we do all term conceptually. So the timing in that sense is sort of poor. So let me ask you, though, except for the exam, if they have any questions that they want to bring up about how that's going to work. Okay. Since I guess I won't see you until Tuesday morning unless you come to the Q&A session, let me just sort of remind you that a good night's sleep is probably more important than any cramming if you are so inclined, because it's often common sense and thinking in doing these exams. And, you know, if a problem's not clear, you should be sure to ask me, because I'd like it to be clear in your head. So, at any rate. So we've been doing rotational motion, and last time we did an example where we looked at the problem with a pulley and two masses with a rope supporting the masses hanging on the pulley, just so able to go up and down. And you've seen that before, but this time we added mass to the pulley, which is to say its moment of inertia is not zero. So that means we really have to take into account the fact that it takes energy, it takes an asymmetry in the forces on that pulley in order to get it to begin rotating. And it has to rotate if the pulleys are going to move. That's part of the problem. So I've drawn up another example here, and I'd like to just sort of quickly go through and do an analysis of this through body diagrams and put down the equations that one would need to solve, just so as another example to bear in mind how to think of it. So the forces that are on this, we have a tension on this mass, we have a force of gravity, and we have a normal force. I could throw in friction if I wanted to, right? And then the direction of friction would depend on what's going on, whether it's moving, you know, the size of friction would depend on whether it's moving or not. Also, the normal force In general, I don't put friction in. You'll find you don't really need to do anything with the normal force because basically all it's doing is saying you're not slamming into the inclined plane or flying off. So the normal force analysis becomes important when you have friction in the problem. On the other mass, I have a tension and I have mg, but you need to be very careful here because if you say that the pulley has a moment of inertia, this tension and that tension are not equal. So you need to be sure to give it a different symbol. So if we look at each of the pieces individually, then we can resolve the gravitational force, I'll say that I have some angle theta here, into a component that is perpendicular to the surface and a component that is parallel to the surface. And this would be theta, which I hope you're comfortable with right now. And this one would be mg times cosine of theta, and this one would be mg times the sine of theta. So if I look at Newton's laws, the sum of the forces in the appropriate directions, in this case being an inclined plane without anything perverse going on in the problem, the motion up and down the plane will be like this, so the natural coordinates are this and that. We have to choose a direction. We'll just choose this direction, I'll call positive. So in that case, if we look at the perpendicular direction over here, then we have that the sum of the forces perpendicular equal to zero because it's not going up and down in the inclined plane. So that would be, I'll call n positive and minus mg cosine theta. Again, you don't care really about this one because I don't have friction in this particular problem. But if I did, you'd have to use this in order to figure something out about the normal. In the parallel direction, the sum of the forces parallel, we'll say, is equal to little m times a. So remember, I'm just doing this one now. And that will be t in the positive direction minus mg sine theta, which will go in the negative direction. If we look at this mass, big M, we have T prime and big MG down. We have only the motion along that line. That corresponds to basically the motion parallel this way, because when this one goes down, that one goes up the inclined plane. So the sum of the forces is equal to big M times A, and that's equal to big M times G minus T prime, where I set the direction downward positive because that's the orientation of the plane is positive. T is not the same T as the other side, very important, but if one of them goes down an inch, the other one goes up an inch, so the A's are the same. Okay? Have one more equation, which you can't forget to do, which is the pulley has to move. If it were massless, you could just forget about it. But it's not massless, so we have to take into account the pulley. So the free body diagram for the pulley, you can ignore the fact that something holds the pulley up. It's yes, there's some normal force on the axis of the pulley, but you don't need to worry about that. So the pulley has a T here and a T prime there. And usually you're given that the pulley has some moment of inertia, or maybe you're given the mass and the radius, etc. But we'll say it has a moment of inertia, I, and we'll say it has a radius, R. Okay? And now what we're trying to do is we have to, as the other things accelerate, the pulley does angular acceleration, right? It has to spin, so it's you have to use the angular form of Newton's laws. So the sum of the torques on the pulley is equal to I times alpha. So now you have to figure what you mean when you say the sum of the torques. Again, we've defined this as sort of the positive direction of rotation. So I'm going to define a positive torque to be the one that would give me an alpha such that it rotates this way, and I'll define the negative torque such that it rotates that way. That's not arbitrary, because I've really already defined the direction of positive orientation, and what I want to do after I've written the angular equation here, I'm going to convert the alpha into A. And I want that A to have the same sign and meaning as the other A's. Okay? Because you're trying to tie all those equations together. So in this case, the forces are at right angles, are tangential, which means the line that joins where the force acts to the center is perpendicular to the force. So we're going to figure out how to do that with vectors, but when the force is perpendicular to that line, then torque is just the distance, the lever arm distance, times the force. So in this case, we have that I alpha is equal to T R times T prime minus R times T. And S is equal to R theta, which means that A is equal to R alpha. I don't know why I always have to do that. It's a glitch in my head. So we have that I times A over R is equal to R T prime minus R T. Very often, you have to put the I in terms of the mass and the radius, which for a wheel, I think, goes as 1/2 mR squared, but you look it up. But now notice, if I have this in 1/2 mR squared, I have three equations in sort of the same variables that are useful. So I have this one. I have, well, I have this one, and I basically have this one. And they all involve the same A, and they have the same T's. So those equations now generally will be sufficient to solve the problem depending on what they're given. And you can do three equations and three unknowns. All the physics is done at this point. You've got the signs right, you've analyzed the forces right. It's just algebra from here on. Okay? Any questions on how to go about that? Yes?
Can you explain again how you got torque equal to RT prime times RT?
I think it will become clearer later this class and maybe Tuesday, because we're about to do the vector stuff with R. But torque is the distance from the axis of rotation to the point where the force is applied times the force. Because the angular force that causes an alpha, which is causes the rotation, cares about where I apply. If I apply the force here by the axis, I get nothing. If I apply it here, I get a lot. So you have to have that scale factor. I'm no doubt confusing matters a little bit because I hesitate to leave a word every time I use this. And the reason is the direction is also important. If I push perpendicular to the axis, I'll get a maximal effect. If I push perpendicular to the line that goes from the axis to where the force goes, I get a maximal effect. If I push with the component along that line, the piece that's along that line does not work to rotate it. So we're about to go into the vector part of rotation, and this will now fall out. But in general, you can think of torque as distance to the axis times the force. And if those are at right angles, that's it. That's all you need to worry about. Okay? So for these types of problems where you have pulleys, the ropes are always tangential to the circle. So they're always automatically at right angles to the line that goes from where the force is to the axis of rotation. So in these types of problems, it's just that radius times the force for the torque sum. Yes? I'm sorry?
How far into this
topic? Oh, okay. So how far into the topic what are we going to do? We're doing nothing with torques, moments of inertia, etc. We stop on the test at rotational kinematics, which basically means just know how to use the constant alpha equations. So you need to know what alpha is, omega, and theta, and how to do a problem if you have constant omega or something. But at that point we break, and then I start talking about the angular version of F equals NA, which is 4 people psi alpha. None of that's on this test. Which I think is a little, it's like the first couple of sections in chapter 10. I did send an email that has that up very specifically, and it will tell you even at what page in the lecture notes where I made the break. If you deleted that, let me know. I'll send it to you again. Okay. So I asked you to look at this before you came. Did anybody do that?
Nobody did that.
Okay. So since you all did that, how many of you think it's 1, 2, 3, 4? So somebody must have calculated it.
All right. So this would be an exam problem on exam 3. In fact, it probably was at one point. I don't know. So, it's... How would you go about it? We have two bodies in the problem. Here's one, little m, little r. And we know that the moment of inertia I is equal to 1/2 times little m r squared. And the free body diagram for this is simple. You just have a tension down on it. So if you just analyze this one piece, you're asked to find an expression for the acceleration of the mass. If the rope does not slip, if this is a pulley and the rope does not slip, then as this goes down, this has to rotate. So the linear measure here is the same as the linear measure along this, which means if this accelerates with A, then I have an alpha here such that the linear A that corresponds to it has to be the same A. Otherwise, the rope is breaking or stretching or something. So that means if I do the sum of I alpha, the sum of the torques, is going to be I times alpha, and that will be just equal to the tension times R, just like we did in the last problem. And I times alpha is the same as 1 half times little m R squared, and alpha is equal to, I always have to do this, A over R. So that would be the acceleration over the little r. So that would be the left-hand side, and that's equal to t times little r. For this mass, big M, I have the same t here. In this case, we have only one tension, and that's the tension on this particular rope. So what's happening is this is like a yo-yo. The rope is just wrapped around it, and it's just unrolling as you go. And we have big M G here. So we know that big M times A is equal to big M G minus T. And I have defined the direction here such that this is what I call positive. So as it goes down, this torque gives it a positive A. So there are your two equations, and you just want to solve for A. So this R squared cancels with the other R's, so I have that A is equal to T times 2 over little m here, and T is equal to MA minus MG over here, no other way, sorry. T is equal to MG minus MA, so big M G minus big M A. So I can substitute in for T, and I have big MG minus big MA times 2 over little m. And you can regroup. So that solve for A, we have 1 plus 2 big M over little m times A is equal to 2 big M G over little m. A is equal to 2 big M over little m times G times 1 over. And then if you do a touch of the algebra here, you can find that this thing is actually equal to the one on the bottom. So there's a little bit of algebra there, but you can convince yourself of the algebra. But if you have an algebra question, just check me on it and you'll work it out. If you have a question on any of this stuff, now's a good time to ask it. So you happy with this? All right. Since you're happy, I think now is a good time for a few moments of reflection. We don't take enough time to ponder the important things in life sometimes. So I would like you to join me for a little bit of reflection. It turns out that rotation actually really is incredibly important in life, and it's a very big part of sports. There are lots of things that rotate in the body. When you're my age, you'll appreciate how hard rotation is in the body, as your knee joints and your ankle joints and your rotator cuffs all begin to demand that you not be stupid and play soccer or lift weights or anything else anymore. So it's a sad fact of life. Some of you may make careers fixing rotation for people. Joint replacements are becoming more real. If you do sports, rotation is everything in a lot of sports. Anybody play baseball?
And go watch baseball. We got players. Okay. What's the difference between a screwball and a curveball? One you spin one way and the other you spin the other way. When we get the fluids, we'll figure out what happens. But the effect, if you're the batter, is one sort of does this as it comes to you and the other does that. So it's a very different thing. If you play tennis, if you come over the ball on a serve, you get a topspin, and the ball as it flies, instead of going like that, will sort of drop right over the edge and then bounce really high and it goes. If you're into diving, what do you do if you want to get lots of rotations? You top, really tight. So it's a very important part of what we do. Have you ever wondered why quarterbacks don't do the lame duck throw? Right? What they do is really cool. They do the... Right? They do this bit. What they're doing is they're spinning the ball. Okay? And so that spin turns out to be absolutely critical if you're going to do much with this football. So, spinning and all this stuff is really important. The thing is, and we have sort of ignored it up until now, it really goes three-dimensional and there's not any way to avoid it. Right? If we look at the rotation of something, this is really different from that. And we have to know that. This is different from that. Totally different things in terms of their effect and etc. So we now have to figure out how to define all the directions of the various things that we've talked about so that we can mathematically deal with all these differences and have it be very well defined. And so that's where we're going now. Just a heads up, we're now sort of going in some ways three-dimensional. Some students would find this mentally the hardest part of Physics 113 because you go three-dimensional. So I know we're just about to have a test, but as soon as the test is over, you want to sort of get thinking about the stuff because this stuff needs probably more jail time than a lot of the stuff that you do. It's also critically important for everything you do in Physics 113 in terms of the learning how to visualize vectors and some of the mathematical things that we're using in this. Even though you may or may not be doing any rotation in 114 or only a little bit, the kind of analysis and thinking about things in 3D is going to be happening a lot in Physics 114 because electricity and magnetism, particularly magnetism, you get lots of things that happen at weird right angles to other vectors. So it's a sort of strange life when you get there. So, at any rate, I think it's also very rich and very cool. And we call this where you start talking about how things move and in the vector world for rotation, we call it rotational dynamics. And this would be stuff in chapter 11. So, okay. So the first thing I want to look at is how do we quantify this versus that, this versus that, right, different speeds, and then this plane of rotation versus any other plane of rotation. So, as you can imagine, there's a lot of stuff there. And although, well, it will truly amaze you, I'm sure, to discover that I can define all that with a single vector. So suppose we have something that's rotating.
Actually, that was sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it is actually very cool. You really can define all that complication with a single vector. It wasn't sort of tongue-in-cheek. It was very tongue-in-cheek. Okay. So what I want to do is to define a vector, which I'll call omega. And you can think of omega as being a vector that lies along the axis of rotation. The length of omega specifies the magnitude of the angular velocity. So, actually, we've already seen omega as the angular velocity. So you might imagine that if omega is zero, it's not spinning. If omega is big, it's spinning very fast. If omega is smallish, it's spinning very slow. So the magnitude of omega tells you the magnitude of the angular velocity. Doesn't specify the direction, but the magnitude of it, okay? We are used to thinking of the direction of the spin to be something, you know, you sort of draw something like that. But that's not a vector, because what's its direction, right? It's, I could do it this way, I could do it like that. I mean, that's not well defined as the thing. It works mentally, so I have no problem, and I always do, sort of draw it on various things, because it mentally gives me a good sense of how things are rotating. But mathematically, it is not well defined at all. However, this vector omega is. So then we now have to start making up some conventions that we use. And this convention, I guess you could call it a right-hand rule. It's one of many that you're going to have in physics. Okay. I would like everyone to raise their right hand. If you need to, you can take a pen and you can write on an R, especially before a test. Because if you do the right-hand rule that sets the conventions with vectors with your left hand, you're wrong 100% of the time. And it happens to at least one student per exam in Physics 114. Usually, Brady, you use a lot more of this. Okay? And I do remind you before, which is your right hand. I strongly urge you to use your right hand and not use your left hand and flip in your mind directions. That doesn't work. So here's an example of a right hand rule that you're going to use. The way the right hand rule works is you have this thing rotating. I've given you the sense of rotation with the gold arrows. So in this case, it's rotating like this where you're concerned, okay? The way the right-hand rule works is you want to grab with your right hand the axis of rotation, like so. And your thumb points in the direction of positive omega. Or another way to think about it is if I don't know what the direction sense of rotation is and all I see is that picture with the vector, and I ask you, how is it rotating? You can figure that out by grabbing the axis so that your thumb is along the omega, and your fingers will curl in the direction of the rotation. Okay? If I do this, if omega is that way, it's rotating like that. If it's rotating like this, I grab the axis such that my fingers are going in the direction of rotation and my thumb goes in the direction of omega. So the opposite sense of rotation is given by the fact that omega is flipped the other direction. Okay? Omega is a vector. So omega has an orientation in space that is not trivial, right? It has content.
If omega is pointing this way, well, that's the axis of rotation, is the direction that omega is pointing. Either way, it gives you the sense of rotation, whether it's this way or that way, but the orientation in space along the line, that is the line that defines the plane of rotation. The plane of rotation is perpendicular to the line of rotation, to the line, the axis of rotation, right? So if omega is like this, then I know the plane of rotation is here. If omega is like that, I know the plane of rotation is here. If omega is here, it's like that. So that one single vector tells me the orientation of the plane of rotation, the sense of the rotation, and the magnitude of the rotation. So it's extremely powerful. You okay with that?
Alright. If omega is increasing with time, then we say that alpha is a vector along omega.
So it's spinning, and it starts spinning faster and faster. In that case, omega and alpha are in the same direction. Alpha is also a vector that is along the axis of rotation.
If omega is decreasing with time, alpha is in the direction opposite to omega.
All right. So this thing is spinning like so and slowing down. Omega is like this toward me because that way my fingers wrap around the axis in the direction of rotation. Because it's slowing down with time, alpha is in the opposite direction here, pointing out at you. If it were speeding up, then alpha would be pointing toward me. Okay?
All right. So let us suppose that we have some sort of extended body, and it is rotating about an axis, which is given, let me do it slightly different, I'll put a little circle here. So this is the axis of rotation. And let us say that we have a force that is applied on this body at some point, I'll say right here. And I'll say that this force is in some direction like so. Okay? We've already seen what a force does to something in order to make it rotate. It gives it an angular acceleration, alpha, and it depends on the moment of inertia of the object. So we've seen that equation, which is that the torque is equal to I times alpha.
Well, we just said that alpha is a vector. Moment of inertia is sort of a mass times radius. That's like a mass in an angular form. And mass is just a number. So moment of inertia, again, is just a number. It just tells you, given a certain angular force on this thing, how hard is it to get an alpha? Just like, you know, the linebacker's mass is a measure of how big a force I would have to introduce in order to get an acceleration for the guy in a football game or something. So torque is equal to I alpha. Alpha is a vector we just saw. Torque is the angular version of force, so it matters what direction and everything it is. So this is now a vector equation, and we need to think a little bit about how to do this. This force, you can imagine here is a vector R that joins the axis of rotation to the point of application of the force. Okay? This, by definition, is always sort of going in a way that's radial from the axis of rotation. Because if you pick any point on whatever it is that's turning, I can draw a straight line from the axis of rotation to that point, and it will always be coming out radially. Okay?
Sometimes we call this the line of action. No. Sorry. Forget I said that. This is the line of action of the force. And what you should notice is that this force can be thought of as having a piece that is perpendicular to R and a piece that is parallel to R. So this force can be thought of as this component and this component.
This piece is the piece of the force that is along this line. That's the piece that does nothing for rotation. If I'm pushing along this line, and there's my axis, I can push lightly, I can push hard as I want, I can put all of my weight on that, and I will not get rotation. The piece that is perpendicular to this line is the piece that gives you the rotation. It's the only piece that's important. This R is the R that we use when we talk about torque. It is the lever arm for where the force is applied. And now what I'm saying is that force always is a vector, and it is only the piece that is perpendicular to R that turns out to be important for rotation.
What I mean by that is it can produce an alpha. The only part that's important for rotation is the part perpendicular to R.
Okay? So, I'd like to remind you very briefly about something we saw earlier in the term where
if I have a force and it's on an object that moves through a distance, which I'll call S, then the work is defined as F dot S. Right? And if things are changing, then you have to do this in an integral and you use the ds. But what does this dot product do for us? What we want to do is multiply the force times the distance, but when we do work, we define the work to only be important if it is a force along the distance that you're moving. So if I pick something up, I do work because I'm exerting a force along the distance that I'm moving. If I just hold it and go this way, the force I'm exerting is like so, and I'm moving like so, so the work is zero, as physics defines it. I mean, I might be doing biological work in order to exert that force, but that's a... We let the biologists worry about that. That's wrong. I know it may be confusing on the MCATs. You have to think about it, but which work do you need? But anyway, so that they're very different. So the thing is, what we had to do was to take these two vectors and find a way of multiplying them in such a way that it projected out that component of one vector along the other. And that type of multiplication we called the dot product. And if these two have an angle theta between them, then it turns out that F times cosine theta is the component that's along S. Or S times cosine theta is the component along F. It works out either way. And what we came up with was a scalar, just a number. How much work? Okay? Now I'm going to define a different type of vector multiplication.
So this we call the dot product.
So I want to define something new. R cross F. This is defined as the cross product of two vectors. In fact, it gives a vector, so the torque is defined as vector R cross F. And what we want to do is to take, to get the magnitude of the torque, we take the magnitude of R and multiply it by the component of F that is perpendicular to R. Okay? So to get that, I'd like to take this R and I move it over here. And I take this F and I put it here such that they have the same sort of configuration that we're used to with the dot product. And if I do that and I say that this is angle theta, then the cross product of these two things, if I only worry about the magnitude for a moment, the magnitude of this thing is going to be equal to the magnitude of R times the magnitude of F. I now want to project out the perpendicular piece. So it's the magnitude of F times the sine of the angle between them. So here, the work is equal to the magnitude of F times the magnitude of S times the cosine of the angle between them.
Because here you're projecting out the piece that's along the other vector and multiplying it. Here you want to project out the piece that's perpendicular to multiply, because that's the only piece that matters for the rotation. And unlike work, you get a scalar. In this case, we actually get a vector. So it's different in terms of it projects out a different piece. It also gives you a vector instead of a scalar. In terms of the direction, in this case, this would be I'm going to write this down. We'll come back to it. But for the notes later, the torque here is equal to R cross F, which is equal to the magnitude of R times the magnitude of F times the sine of the angle between them, and it is into the board. So there is a unit vector here. I know that's not written all that clearly. This equation, the magnitude is this, where that's projecting out the magnitude of F that's along R. I mean, it's perpendicular to R. And I have to give it a direction now, which I call into the board. So now how do I get that? Let's suppose that we have two vectors. This isn't just torque. You're going to use this kind of thing a lot. This is a type of vector multiplication that will be useful, particularly in Physics 114. So you're going to have to get real good at this. Suppose I have a vector B and some other vector A. And let's say that wherever those vectors are in the problem, I orient them so that their tails are to each other. So when I talk about the opening angle between two vectors, I mentally orient them this way, and I'm talking about this angle. Okay? And if I ask, what is A cross B? Okay. So when we say cross product, the lingo is, you may hear it called the vector cross product. Someone may just call it A cross B. Okay? It does look like the Roman numeral X. It also looks like normal multiplication symbol times on many instances. So I don't know what to say. You have to take out your little decoder ring and you'll have to figure it out by context. But be very careful when you're doing problems where you actually have an X in the problem. You might start using a sort of script X for those. Sorry. I didn't invent these things. I mean, I think you literally fall into the problem of there aren't enough symbols for us, so we reuse things. So it can be confusing, and you do have to be careful. At any rate, A cross B is going to be equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the sine of the angle between them, and the direction is given by the right-hand rule. Okay? What right-hand rule? There's no wheel turning here. Right. So now this is right-hand rule number two. In this right-hand rule, note that the way that I've written these things, A and B are in the plane. They're in the same plane. Any two vectors will form a plane. In this case, it's the plane of the board. Okay? To determine the direction of the cross product, it turns out the cross product is going to be perpendicular to this plane. Okay? Now that may not... Okay, I'll tie it into the rotation in a second. The cross product will be perpendicular to the plane. So really the issue is it coming out of the board or going into the board? So you have to get your orientation for that. There is a right-hand rule that we use for this. The way that it is done is in the plane of the board, You look at it, and you pretend that there's something like an axis coming in and out where those two vectors meet at the tip, okay? And you grab that axis in such a way that your fingers go along the first vector in the cross products. They go along B. Okay? So I'm going to grab the axis so that my fingers go along B. And remember, the axis is perpendicular to the plane of those two vectors. So I'm grabbing it like this. My fingers are along B. And then you curl your fingers in the direction of the other vector, where the angle is smaller, right? I could imagine curling it around the other way, but there the angle is very big. So do it in the direction where the opening angle, what you would call the opening angle. Put your fingers along, do that. When you do, your thumb is going in the direction of the cross product.
Can you explain that again? Yes.
Oh, I will explain it again. I'll explain about 50 times probably. It's sort of hard to get. So let me try this again. Okay. Probably need a visual. Okay. Okay. So you've got your A and the B. You take your four fingers and you put them along B. Okay? But if I just do that, okay, they're my four fingers, they're along B, I don't know how to orient my hand. Right? I can have them along B and do a dance or whatever. Okay? So you have to orient. What you need to notice is if I orient it like this and stick my thumb out, it's coming out at you. If I orient like this and stick my thumb out, it's going the other way. So it may seem completely arbitrary, but it's not. The rule is that you orient your fingers such that you, when you curl your right hand fingers, they go into the direction of A. Okay? But you do it in the direction of the small angle that joins the two vectors. Because if I do it like this, I'm going around the big and I'm oriented the other way. When you get that right, you orient your fingers and you curl them such that they grasp the axis curling in the direction toward the other vector, then your thumb is pointing in the direction of orientation of the cross product. Notice, if I use my left hand, it's the opposite direction. Okay? So you do get it absolutely 100% wrong. Okay? Yes.
How do you know to orient your fingers to B instead of starting up by orienting them to A?
Because I said B cross A. If I say A cross B, then I put my fingers along A, I curl them in the direction of the smallest angle, so I have my fingers pointing like so, I curl them in that direction, and B cross A is out. Notice, I'm sorry, A cross B, right? The first vector in, when you say the cross product, the first vector is the one that you use for your fingers, okay? So if I say B cross A, I put my fingers along B, I curl in the direction A, my thumb goes into the board, so the cross product is at right angles to both those vectors going into the board. If I say A cross B, it's going to be cross A, I'm now saying A cross B, fingers along A, curl in B, I go the opposite way. So A cross B is a vector that is opposite in direction from B cross A. It's different again from the dot product because this is just a number, there's no direction. F dot S is equal to S dot F. It's okay?
What do I do with that? Suppose they are parallel. What is the cross product to that? What is the direction of it? Sine angle, the sine of the angle is zero, right? Because the sine theta is zero. You also don't have a direction. I mean, there's no direction. The thing is zero. In the dot product, remember, it is zero when the two vectors are perpendicular to one another. In the cross product, it is zero when they're parallel to one another because there is no perpendicular component. Okay? So now, if we go back to the rotation, note that the cross product gives us exactly what we need in order to talk about rotation. What will happen if this thing is able to spin about this axis? How is it going to spin if I act on it with that force? Here it is. It's pinned around this axis. And I act on it with a force going like that. It's going to cause it to rotate like this. Right? So I know if I act on it with this force, it's going to spin like this. If it spins like that, then you can say that it is causing a positive omega, which would be into the board, right? Because it has to spin in the direction that your fingers curl. Okay? So omega is a vector that's into the board. So alpha has to be a vector that points into the board. Look at R cross F. R cross F is equal to R times F times sine theta. So it multiplies this lever arm by the perpendicular component of F only, and it gives you an orientation, R cross F, fingers a long R. If I move F over to here, I curl them into the F, I have my thumb pointing into the board, which is the direction of omega, I'm sorry, direction of alpha, which you have to have because this vector and that vector have to have the same direction. Because it's a vector equation. So, when you define the torque as R cross F, it brings out all the pieces you need to make this work. Questions?
Which two vectors have to be in the same orientation?
In this equation, it's a vector equation, and that means that this side has to have the same direction also as that side, right? It's both an algebraic a magnitude equality, but it's also a directional equality. So it's exactly the same as F equals ma. If I say I have a vector F on the body, what direction is the acceleration? It's also in the direction of that net. So it's the same sort of thing. Okay, so we're sort of going three dimensions. I want to put you on to some other sort of notation. Here's a vector that goes to your right. Here's a vector that goes to the left. Here's a vector that goes up on the orientation of the board. This is a vector that comes out of the board. And this is a vector, and yes, it's a stupid X, that goes into the board. So if you have the vector diagram, if you're looking at it, and you see dots, or the little X's, the way to think about it is imagine an arrow that is going out of the board or into the board. If an arrow is coming at your eyeball, you see the point. If it is going away from you, you see the feathers. Okay? Put that in your little decoder room.
Fetters means going away. Okay? Physics is weird that way. Imagine Einstein sitting there going, fetters. Yeah. Into the paper. Alright, so we have to do this because now the world has just become three-dimensional. I can have the R and the F in the plane of the paper. I can write it that way. The torque is going to be at right angles to it. Okay? So let me ask you a question. That's R. Here's F. What is the direction of the torque? R is a vector that's coming out at you. F is going straight up. Fingers along R. Curl your fingers in the direction of the smallest angle to F, which is the 90 degrees from this direction, straight up like that. It is not all the way around, okay? So you orient it such that you can be in the plane of the two vectors and curl your fingers in that plane, smallest angle joining R to F. So, because it's R cross F, so you start with the long R. Cross F, the torque is that way. If you use your left hand, you said that way, and you're wrong. Okay? So, R cross F is like that way. So, we have in the linear world, we have the distance, which we might call x or s or whatever. I'll call it s. We have vector velocity. We have angular velocity. Acceleration, sorry. We have mass. We have force. We have kinetic energy. And we have momentum, which is a vector quantity. This goes into the rotational world, where we tend to have theta. Ooh. We have omega that we just learned is a vector. The angular acceleration is a vector. The mass turns into the moment of inertia. The force we saw is the torque. 1/2 mv squared goes into 1/2 I omega squared. And now we need to come out with the analog for momentum. And the analog for momentum is called the angular momentum, and it's I omega, which you might imagine because the angular mass is I, and in the linear world, you say V, and angular V is omega. So that might be the thing that you would naturally imagine. So,
In the Newtonian linear world, we have F is equal to dP over dt, right? Which is, if we ignore the changing mass term, that's equal to mdv over dt, which is ma. And remember that we have, if we have an isolated system, we have conservation of linear momentum. So the torque, the comparable equation is the torque is equal to the time derivative of the angular momentum, which is I d omega over dt, because the angular momentum is I omega. And if the body keeps its same mass, so that I doesn't change during whatever's going on, then the time derivative comes out into just the time derivative of omega. So this is equal to I times alpha. And just like what we had in the linear world, we have conservation of angular momentum. L start is equal to L end if you are not acted on by some external force. This is a vector equation, which means it is only true, it's true in three dimensions, and you can have forces along one dimension and not along the other. So you can imagine having angular momentum conserved along an axis, if you will. So what does that mean? That means that I omega at the start is equal to I, the sum of the I omegas at the end. So the moment of inertia or omega can change, but the product has to be the same. Okay? So I need a volunteer. Lilac, come on down.
Lilac doesn't mess it up.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, that's why I had to go for it. So okay, don't mess it up, all right? Okay. Have a seat. This is just a stool, but it is a stool that has an axis that's free to rotate approximately. So what I would like you to do is to take this and this, and now I want you to hold them out straight. Good, good. I really suck, don't I? Okay. Alright, you let him down, rest for a second. Alright. Now, put him out. Okay, put your feet up on the stool. Okay. Now, I'm going to spin you. Okay. Now, I want you to pull them into your chest. Now, out. In. Out. What'd you see? What did he change? I wasn't touching him, right? What was changing? Let me say it another way. What was happening with this moment of inertia? Starts out here. How does it change when he does this? What is moment of inertia? It's every little bit of mass times r squared, where r is the distance to the axis of rotation. So think about the dumbbells. You have the masses out here, they're at very large distance, so you have a large moment of inertia. When you pull it in, that moment of inertia gets smaller. Because the moment of inertia gets smaller and you have angular momentum conservation, this gets smaller over here, which means the omega has to be bigger. So when you pull it in, you speed up. And when you then go back out, you slow it down. So, thank you.
So,
notes on this. One, you'll notice I put him down and had him do this. I believe it happened here. I can't tell you the details, but the story was given to me that a professor in this class was doing this demo, started with these things here, had the student spin him up, did this, and hit the student in the face and knocked out him. So, yeah. Can you imagine? So, I want to just leave one other visual. Have you ever noticed in ice skating, when they go into a spin, they go like that, and then they spin it up? And have you ever noticed that just before they stop their spin, they do that? Yeah? Now you know why. Because now they're not that way. The moment they do this, omega is reduced dramatically. Okay? It's all about the moment of inertia.